Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2008. Ruination, the early years.
You know, if you look at the internet today, we are basically all living in this incredibly sterile, like, focus-grouped showroom.
Oh, absolutely. Everyone is completely obsessed with their personal brand.
Right. Every single photo has a filter. Every public statement feels like it was, I don't know, vetted by a crisis PR team.
Yeah, the messy, chaotic realities of just being a human being they're basically scrubbed completely clean.
It's exhausting, honestly. We've collectively trained ourselves to hide the clutter in the background of the Zoom call, you know?
We hide the weird quirks. We present this hyper-optimized version of ourselves because, well, the algorithms reward aesthetic perfection.
Exactly. But when you step into the time machine and travel back to the world of early 2008 podcasting.
Oh, boy.
Specifically the corner of the internet we are exploring today. That pristine showroom window doesn't just get cracked.
No, it gets completely shattered with a brick.
It really does. We are looking at a digital landscape that is completely unvarnished, highly explicit, and just gloriously, wonderfully messy.
It is the absolute antithesis of curated perfection. What we're looking at is a space where a host's flaws, his bodily functions, his domestic annoyances, they aren't hidden away in shame.
No, they are the main attraction.
Exactly. They are the content.
I'm King.
And I'm Gail.
And welcome to Ruination, the early years. Today, we have a very specific mission.
We really do. We are cracking open the archives of the Big Fatty Online Universe, or BFO for the initiated.
Right. And we're doing a deep dive into the source material spanning Monday, July 28th through Friday, August 1st, 2008.
Which covers episodes 127 through 131.
And the sheer whiplash of the content from this specific week is just, it's staggering.
Oh, it'll give you vertigo. In a single hour, you are going to hear about high society retail openings in historic Charleston.
Which is so fancy.
Right. But then that's followed immediately by hyper-visceral, deeply uncomfortable gastrointestinal emergencies.
Yeah, that's quite a pivot. We're also going to see some really aggressive audience policing techniques.
And we're going to feel the inescapable, like, physical gravitational pull of the BFO community.
Because the overarching theme for our deep dive into the source material today is figuring out exactly how the host, Big Fatty, uses his literal physical existence as the ultimate glue.
How his geography, his apartment, and his own biology bond him permanently to you, his listeners.
So let's start by looking at where he places himself in the physical world, because the contrast is pretty fascinating.
Yeah, over the weekend leading into the July 28th broadcast, he recounts his Saturday morning trip to what he affectionately dubs the Apple Snack Store.
Oh, this is such a wild time capsule. This is the grand opening of the very first Apple Store in South Carolina.
Right on King Street in Charleston.
And we really need to set the scene for what an Apple Store opening meant in 2008, right? The very first iPhone had only come out a year prior.
They were massive cultural events. These stores were basically built like cathedrals of modern technology.
Right. Sleek, silver, completely spotless.
They were the physical embodiment of that pristine, curated culture we were just talking about.
And Big Fatty makes sure to note that they opened the doors at exactly 10 in the morning.
And he was there. He attended this massive retail event with his frequent companion, Larry Cly.
He describes the store and specifically notes, with a bit of pride, honestly, that this is where, quote, all the cool kids were.
Naturally, he places himself right dead center in that demographic.
Oh, of course. And they even got the promotional swag. They handed out these free black t-shirts featuring the silver Apple logo with King Street stamped across the front.
But the truly wild part of this story is how it intersects with local mainstream media.
Yes, because this wasn't just a bunch of tech nerds buying iPods.
No, this was treated as a major local news event. The local television station was out there capturing B-roll footage of the massive crowds.
And guess who was featured prominently in that footage?
Big Fatty.
Prominently. He actually jokes on the show that if he was going to be featured in a crowd shot, it was obviously going to be prominently.
Which is just a great self-deprecating line. But the ultimate validation for him came when a listener named Miss Kitty actually called the show.
Oh, right. The voice letter.
Yeah. She called to tell him she saw him on the evening news broadcast. and she explicitly dubbed him a rock star.
And just to prove that Miss Kitty wasn't, you know, exaggerating the scale of this event, he mentions driving by that exact same Apple store the very next day.
Sunday evening, right before they closed.
And the place was still so completely jam-packed with people that they had a literal police officer standing guard at the front door doing crowd control.
Okay, wait, I have to push back on something here because this is where my brain gets a little stuck.
What's that?
Think about the branding clash happening in this moment. Apple, especially in 2008, is the pinnacle of sterile control design.
Everything is white, everything is uniform.
Right. And then you have Big Fatty, whose entire brand is intentionally chaotic, explicitly vulgar, and self-described as ruined.
Yeah, it's a total mismatch.
So why is he so eager to be a part of this? Like, is he actually just craving validation from mainstream high-end consumerism? Does he just want to be one of the cool kids?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Because to me, it almost feels like a subtle subversion. Like he is intentionally crashing their sterile party.
Oh, that's an interesting way to look at it.
Yeah. He's this self-proclaimed fat one running a filthy underground podcast, and he has successfully inserted himself into the pristine, sanitized B-roll of the local evening news.
He's claiming space in a world that usually demands aesthetic perfection.
Exactly. And he's doing it completely on his own terms.
I think you're hitting on a really core tension in his personality. He genuinely enjoys the mainstream recognition. I mean, he clearly loves the rock star label from Miss Kitty.
Who wouldn't?
Right. But he instantly filters that mainstream event through his own ruined lens. He takes this highly corporate Apple experience and immediately digests it into BFO lore.
But to your point about his physical presence in the world, he wasn't just indulging in high-end retail therapy that weekend.
No, not at all. He was simultaneously engaging in some incredibly grueling, boots-on-the-ground community work.
The stamina this man has is just absurd. If you look at the rest of his itinerary from that single weekend, it is exhausting just to read.
It really is. So Friday night, before he even goes to the Apple store, he's at Patrick's Pub hosting a basket raffle fundraiser.
Okay, and then Saturday morning is the Apple opening.
But by Saturday night, he and the members of the Hard Group are packing up and hitting the road for another fundraiser all the way up in Myrtle Beach.
They should probably pause and explain some of this lore for the uninitiated, right? Because he throws these terms around assuming everyone is keeping up.
Yeah, that's a good idea. So the Hard Group refers to his specific, tight-knit group of friends and fellow drag performers.
And they frequently travel together to do these charity events.
Right. And they travel in a very specific vehicle, which he casually refers to as Tiara.
Or sometimes Har-4.
Exactly. And they are deeply tied to the BFO lore surrounding what they call the Horror Hotel.
Which is actually the Metropolis Entertainment Complex over in Augusta, Georgia. It's this massive hub for their underground community.
So he and the Har Group load into Tiara, drive to Myrtle Beach, do this fundraiser, and he proudly reports the exact financial achievement on Monday's broadcast.
What was the grand total?
Across the Patrick's Pub raffle and the Myrtle Beach event, they managed to scrape together a total of $693 for their cause.
That is grassroots, dollar-by-dollar fundraising right there. But the weekend isn't even over.
Not even close.
Sunday evening brings him right back down to reality and right back to Charleston. He has to run a rehearsal for a local community theater play he is directing.
Right. It's called Buxy Blues, which he plugs as opening on September 12th.
And his directing style is, well, it's basically dictatorial perfection.
It really is. He tells the audience he managed to brutally force his cast through 10 pages of blocking.
And you know, community theater actors, they always want to know their internal emotional state, right?
Oh, always.
So they start asking him for their character's motivation for moving to a specific spot on the stage.
And Big Fatty delivers this incredibly blunt response.
He looks at them and says, "Your fucking motivation is because I told you to move there."
Which is just hilarious.
Mm.
But look at the complete dichotomy of his life over a 48-hour period.
It's extreme. Friday and Saturday involve highly explicit behavior, drag personas, underground bar circuits, and general ruination on the road to Myrtle Beach.
And then Sunday night, he is engaged in earnest, foundational community theater, meticulously blocking out a stage play and wrangling amateur actors like a frustrated school teacher.
It really proves that his commitment to his local community isn't just talk. Like, he isn't just sitting in an air-conditioned room talking into a microphone.
No, he is a physical pillar of his local scene. He's moving people around, raising physical cash, driving across state lines.
But And here is where the reality of the human body comes crashing in, all of that grueling travel, the back and forth between Charleston, Augusta, and Myrtle Beach.
Oh no, I know where this is going.
It takes a massive physical toll.
It really does. Which brings us to Tuesday, July 29th, and honestly, one of the most visceral, unforgettable concepts ever introduced in the BFO universe.
I still can't believe we have to talk about this, but it is totally central to the theme today. Tuesday's broadcast introduces the listeners to the deeply physiological phenomenon Big Fatty calls vacation poop.
He describes this with a level of vivid, horrifying detail that is almost medically fascinating.
He explains the exact physical response his body has when he returns to his apartment building after a long trip.
He tells the audience that as he steps into the elevator and the elevator gets closer and closer to his floor, his sphincter literally begins to pinch tighter and tighter.
Oh my gosh. He makes the bold, on-the-record medical claim that simply arriving home is, quote, the best laxative on earth.
And the imagery he paints is just so desperate. He describes finally getting his apartment door open,
right,
dropping his heavy luggage right in the dead center of the living room floor, and having to absolutely sprint to the bathroom.
Because, in his own words, if he doesn't make that sprint, he is going to experience a colonic explosion in my underpants.
Which he casually notes would then have to be immediately burned.
Naturally. And he doesn't just share this as a self-deprecating joke. He issues a direct, earnest plea to the audience.
He does. He asks them if they suffer from the exact same affliction when they travel.
He claims that this intense, panicked urgency is, quote, not all in my mind, it's really all in my colon.
Okay, so explain the psychology here, because on the surface, this is just a guy with absolutely zero verbal filter who overshares because he likes hearing himself talk.
Why broadcast this to thousands of people?
It is easy to dismiss it as just a total lack of a filter. But if you look at how it functions within the community, it is a masterclass in the strategy of radical vulnerability.
How so?
Well, think about the psychological mechanics of what he is doing. By completely stripping away all of his dignity and describing a desperate, sweaty sprint to his own toilet, he is forcing an intense, almost uncomfortable level of intimacy upon the listener.
Like, you are in the bathroom with him whether you want to be or not.
Exactly. If a listener hears that story, accepts that level of deeply unglamorous oversharing, and chooses not to hit pause and unsubscribe, they are essentially permanently bonded to the host.
They have seen behind the curtain in the most literal biological sense.
It separates the casual listeners from the diehards.
You know, it's like the body's subconscious stress response when a ship finally crosses into a safe harbor after a violent storm.
And that's a great analogy.
During the storm, or in his case, the chaos of Myrtle Beach, the crew is tense, adrenaline is pumping, everything is locked down tight just for survival.
Right.
But the absolute second, the subconscious brain recognizes the safety of the harbor, or the sanctuary of his apartment, which he calls the villa, the alarm bells shut off.
And the physical dam just breaks. The body realizes it is finally safe to let go.
That's exactly it. He experiences the biological reality, yes, but the genius is in the choice to leave it in the final edit of the podcast.
Because he doesn't just manage his own physical boundaries and biological realities with this audience.
Not at all. He aggressively and sometimes ruthlessly manages the boundaries and the loyalty of the audience itself.
Oh, ruthlessly is definitely the right word. This ties perfectly into the Wednesday, July 30th broadcast,
where he initiates what can only be described as a digital hostage negotiation.
The Podfade roll call.
Yes. He opens Wednesday's show visibly and audibly frustrated by a sudden, inexplicable drought in what he calls voice letters.
And we really need to contextualize what a voice letter was in 2008, because it's so different now.
Yeah, today audience interaction is completely frictionless. You double tap a screen, you leave a YouTube comment, you're done in 3 seconds.
But back then, leaving a voice letter meant actually dialing a physical K7 or a Google Voice phone number.
Waiting for the beep.
Right, and essentially leaving a voicemail monologue that you knew was going to be broadcast to thousands of people.
It required massive friction and honestly, a lot of bravery.
It was a high-effort contribution.
Yeah.
And when those contributions dry up, Big Fatty doesn't just put out a polite request for more calls.
Oh, no. He decides to publicly name and shame the specific listeners he suspects of podfading.
Podfading, which was the early podcast term for silently unsubscribing or just drifting away from a show without saying goodbye.
And he doesn't just name two or three people off the top of his head. He literally pulls up the digital listener pin map on his website
and begins systematically reading off locations and real names to call out the missing.
It plays out like a disappointed school principal reading the detention list over the PA system.
He goes down the list with incredible specificity. He calls out Sharon Fluids, making sure to note that she was the loyal listener who previously sent him a box of condoms to take to gay days.
He calls out Turnip Head. He demands to know the whereabouts of Tara from Flint, Michigan, and Zipper over in Los Angeles.
He targets Michael in Portland and Monique in Kyle, Texas. I mean, he scans the entire globe.
He calls out Nico, Eric in Bakersfield, and then, yeah, he goes international. He calls out Akuma in Tokyo and Nancy from Japan.
And he makes sure to remind the audience exactly who Nancy is.
By mentioning she recently sent him a physical picture of a squirrel with giant testicles in the mail.
Because of course she did. It is just peak BFO.
He rounds out the interrogation list with Eric in Seattle, and then he specifically targets Kim Beaver.
Oh, poor Kim. He notes with extreme annoyance that Kim only ever sends written e-letters and flat out refuses to call the voice letter line.
Okay, but my favorite part of this entire roll call is that he targets David in Denver.
Yes, and the real-time feedback loop of this community is so tight that by the very next day's broadcast, David in Denver has already frantically sent an e-letter to confirm his loyalty.
He's practically sweating through the email, assuring Big Fatty that he is absolutely still listening.
That the thought of unsubscribing is impossible.
And that he, quote, loves some fat still.
The policing tactic worked flawlessly. The threat of public shaming totally mobilized the base.
It really did. And while he is demanding these voice letters, we get some incredible, hilarious details about the specific quirks of his dedicated listeners.
Like Freddie in Texas.
Yes. He mentions an e-letter from Freddie. Now, Freddie's chosen username on the message board is Fly in the Buttermilk.
But because of the technical limitations of 2008 email software, it truncates long display names.
Right. So every single time Freddie sends a heartfelt message to the show, it arrives in Big Fatty's inbox looking like it came from Fly in the Butt.
And Big Fatty just absolutely revels in that accidental technical comedy. He doesn't fix it. He leans right into it.
We also get an amazing update from one of his most colorful international listeners, Straight Bob from Melbourne, Australia.
Oh, Straight Bob. He calls in specifically to proudly accept the mantle of the official Southern Hemisphere media whore.
He leaves this message signing off with a literal verbal meow.
And casually mentions to the audience that he is currently calling in from the C word hunt.
Which is just an incredible sentence to drop into a Wednesday podcast.
It really is. But this entire segment, the roll call and the listener highlights, reveals the foundational social contract of the BFO universe.
How does he view his listeners?
Exactly. He does not view them as passive consumers who just download an MP3 file for their morning commute. He treats them as members of a highly exclusive, demanding club that comes with strict participation obligations.
Right. If you put your pin on that map, you owe the show your voice. You owe him your, quote, good gosh and damey.
But I have a serious question about this tactic.
Go for it.
Isn't publicly shaming individual private listeners by name on a global broadcast a massive risk?
Oh, huge.
Like if a podcast host today called me out by name and yelled at me for not commenting enough, I would instantly unsubscribe out of spite.
It is a high wire act of audience manipulation. Hmm. It completely violates the unwritten rule of modern media consumption, which is that the audience is allowed to remain anonymous and passive.
So why does it work for him?
Because it plays on a deep-seated human desire to be seen and recognized by the community leader, even if that recognition comes in the form of a reprimand.
It's almost a teacher-student dynamic.
Yes. The audience responds to the discipline because it proves that Big Fatty is actually paying attention to them. They aren't just a download statistic. They are missed when they are gone.
That is fascinating. So he is micromanaging his audience's behavior. But what's equally interesting is how he manages the macro world.
Right, because while he is aggressively tracking the movements of Tara from Flint, he is also rigorously tracking the massive global news events spinning outside his window.
Yes, which transitions us perfectly into Thursday, July 31st. Big Fatty is broadcasting from his home studio, which he affectionately dubs the Fat Cave.
And he decides to tackle the national news cycle.
Specifically, he addresses a sudden, massive earthquake that had just rolled through Southern California.
Now, a normal news broadcast would talk about fault lines and property damage, right?
Yeah.
But how does Big Fatty process a major natural disaster? Entirely through the lens of biological anxiety.
A listener named James in Los Angeles actually calls into the show, probably while the aftershocks are still rattling his windows, just to make a hyper-specific BFO inside joke.
James says that if Big Fatty had been visiting the California area, like Palm Springs, when that quake hit, the sheer terror of the tremors absolutely would have caused another colonic explosion.
It is brilliant. A massive tectonic event is instantly reduced to its hypothetical impact on Big Fatty's sphincter.
And he continues this trend of hyper-localized macroeconomics. 2008 was the height of a massive gas price crisis. It was national news every single night.
And Big Fatty gives a triumphant localized update, reporting that gas prices at his specific neighborhood Charleston BP station have plummeted all the way down to $3.79 a gallon.
And keeping with the theme of the week, he cannot resist making the joke that the reason gas is suddenly so cheap in his specific zip code is due to an overabundance of his own personal gassiness.
He takes global oil markets and literal tectonic plate shifts and filters them entirely through the micro world of his ongoing bodily function narrative.
It's incredible. But he also keeps a razor-sharp focus on the entertainment industry. He dives into a massive TMZ exclusive regarding an absolute scandal on the sacred institution of television, The Price is Right.
Oh, this story is amazing. He details how the famous Plinko game board had been intentionally rigged by the television producers.
They locked it so the chips would hit the $10,000 center slot every single time.
And they did this specifically to shoot a flawless promotional commercial.
But in a massive catastrophic failure of production protocol, some crew member completely forgot to unrig the board after the commercial shoot wrap.
Right, so during the taping of the actual legitimate show, an unsuspecting contestant steps up to play, starts dropping the chips, and immediately, effortlessly racks up $30,000 in a matter of seconds.
Big Fatty gleefully reports that when the producers finally realized their monumental error, they literally had to halt production, stop the tape, run out onto the stage to unfix the game, and then edit the entire embarrassing segment out of the television broadcast.
Though he does note, with a definite hint of satisfaction for the little guy sticking it to the network, that the show was legally forced to let the contestant keep the $30,000.
He just loves exposing the flaws and incompetence in massive television productions.
He really does. And he also gives his rapid-fire, highly opinionated updates on the reality TV landscape.
Oh, yeah. He notes the shifting dynamics in the Big Brother house, confidently predicting the arrogant bodybuilder Jesse is going home.
And he makes sure his audience knows the broadcast schedule has moved to Thursdays.
He also dissects the absolute mess that is the reality show The Baby Borrowers. He reports that the couple Dayton and Morgan have completely quit the show.
And he delivers a scathing, definitive, aesthetic judgment on a contestant named Kelly. He deems her completely vile and claims her negativity is literally contagious.
But amidst all this cynical reality TV criticism and TMZ gossip, he offers a rare moment of pure, unadulterated theatrical joy.
He reviews a stage production of Mary Poppins that he saw, and he is absolutely mesmerized by the complex choreography specifically designed for the song Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
He breaks down how the actors perform a highly intricate, specific hand or body movement for every single letter they spell out during the incredibly fast song.
He is so genuinely impressed by this physical feat that he publicly admits this new stage performance has completely replaced his own long-standing made-up gibberish word.
Which, for the record, was docisali expistic fragical rupus.
He literally concedes defeat to the stage professionals. It's a rare moment of humility.
It really is. And this Thursday segment also brings us a fantastic piece of character lore regarding Andy Vera Charles.
She is a recurring, fictionalized figure in the BFO universe, often referred to affectionately as the old gal.
Big Fatty plays an audio clip from her show where she is literally having a back-and-forth conversation with her own conscience.
And the incredible punchline is that her conscience sounds exactly, unmistakably, like Kermit the Frog.
And Big Fatty, ever the armchair physician, immediately diagnoses Auntie Vera with a severe case of Alzheimer's disease.
And he theorizes that the recent Southern California earthquake must have rattled the marbles in her head to exacerbate the condition.
If we analyze this entire sequence of events, the earthquakes, the gas prices, the Plinko scandal, Kermit the Frog, we see exactly how his mind works as a broadcaster.
He processes national news and cultural touchstones entirely through his highly specific, insular, BFO lens.
The macro world, the grand events of society, they only truly matter insofar as they provide material for the micro world of his podcast. He acts as the interpretive center of the universe.
But as we're about to see, while Big Fatties absolutely loves to sit safely in the Fat Cave and critique reality TV producers for their technical mistakes and mock Apple store openings,
yeah,
his own production standards and his deeply held belief in his own technological superiority are about to be put to the absolute ultimate test.
Which brings us to a highly necessary, mandatory segment for our deep dive today into the source material. We must formally announce this segment as Ruined Rumination,
where we address and correct an error from Big Fatty's past broadcasts.
Welcome to Ruined Ruination. This is the great saga of Ryan Starr Jones and the impenetrable wall of Big Fatty's iTunes denial.
Let's lay out the facts of the incident as they occurred. A dedicated listener named Ryan Starr Jones leaves an incredibly angry, frustrated voice letter for the show.
Ryan is highly stressed out. He is driving all the way down to Miami for a 1:30 p.m. legal hearing.
And you have to understand the context of 2008 technology. You couldn't just stream a podcast over a cellular network in your car.
No, you had to physically plug your iPod into your desktop computer with a 30-pin cable.
Open the iTunes software, wait for the RSS feed to download the heavy MP3 file over your home broadband, sync the device, and then take the iPod to your car.
It was a delicate, easily broken process. And for Ryan, the process broke. The latest BFO episode completely failed to download to his iPod due to some mysterious iTunes error.
And the ultimate insult, the reason Ryan is so furiously angry in his voicemail, is that this technical failure forced him to sit in his car for hours and listen to a rival podcast.
Archer's stream show, instead of Big Fatty.
Now, Big Fatty's initial reaction to this complaint on the Thursday show is total, unwavering, aggressive denial. He goes completely on the offensive.
He verbally spanks Ryan on the air. He vehemently claims that his audio files are perfect, that his RSS feed is flawless, and that his shows have downloaded perfectly for everyone else all week without a single hitch.
He explicitly and aggressively blames the entire massive issue on Ryan's personal computer hardware.
And he doesn't just blame him, he punishes him. Big Fatty actually demands that Ryan perform two specific random acts of kindness by Friday as a mandatory penance for even daring to make the insinuation that the BFO feed was somehow broken.
It is a spectacular, blinding display of misplaced confidence.
Because the correction, which finally arrives the very next day on the Friday, August 1st broadcast, is a massive, highly public slice of humble pie.
Yes. By Friday, Big Fatty is forced to confront objective reality and admit the truth on the air. It turns out, it wasn't Ryan's fault at all.
Nope. Apple had just released an automatic emergency software update, specifically iTunes version 7.7.1 for Mac users.
And the entire explicit purpose of this global software patch was to fix a massive, widespread systemic bug that was completely breaking podcast downloads across the entire platform.
It was a systemic flaw in Apple's architecture. Ryan Starr Jones was completely innocent.
And to make matters worse for Big Fatty's arrogant defense, other prominent listeners within the community, like Jason from the podcast The Way We See It, also stepped forward to publicly report that they were experiencing the exact same iTunes download issue.
The evidence was insurmountable. He was cornered by the facts.
Let's unpack the psychology of Big Fatty's reflex to aggressively defend his own technical prowess here. What makes this so hypocritical, and honestly so entertaining to listen to, is that Big Fatty has built a significant portion of his brand on claiming he is entirely technologically illiterate.
Right. He frequently boasts that he doesn't use the computras or modern cell phones. He acts like technology is beneath him.
But the absolute second a listener suggests his technical fault with his podcast delivery, Big Fatty immediately assumes a posture of supreme technological superiority over his listener's hardware.
He essentially says, "I don't know how computers work, but I know mine is better than yours." It's incredible defensive arrogance.
But, and this is the crucial part that saves his relationship with the audience, time and time again, his overriding commitment to radical honesty ultimately forces his hand.
He can't lie to them. He has to read the truth about the Apple software update on the air the very next day.
He effectively vindicates Ryan Starr Jones completely, proving Ryan was right all along.
Even though, if you listen closely to the audio, Big Fatty masterfully avoids issuing a direct formal apology for the verbal spanking. He never actually says the words, "I am sorry."
He concedes the factual reality of the bug, but he maintains his positional authority as the host. It is a masterful evasion of true culpability.
Okay, think about this in your own life. Have you ever aggressively, passionately defended yourself in a heated argument, completely 100% convinced of your own rightness.
Oh, yeah.
Only to secretly realize the very next morning that you were factually completely wrong. Think about the burning shame of that realization.
It's the worst feeling in the world.
It is. But look at how Big Fatty handles this exact scenario. It proves a foundational, unbreakable rule of the BFO universe. The host is never, ever truly wrong.
He is simply temporarily inconvenienced by the failures of a multi-billion-dollar tech conglomerate like Apple. The ego remains completely intact.
It is a remarkable display of narrative control. And with those technological hurdles miraculously resolved by the engineers at Apple, Big Fatty uses the Friday show to take a breath, look forward to the end of the week, and pivot to celebrating milestones.
And preparing to welcome a very specific, highly anticipated guest into his physical home.
Which leads us to the final act of this week's saga. Friday, August 1st, is a day of major transitions. Big Fatty announces that it marks the official end of National Baked Bean Month.
A culinary celebration he honors by joyfully reciting the classic playground rhyme about beans being the magical fruit.
And he also notes that August 1st itself is National Random Act of Kindness Day, which ties perfectly back to his penance demands for Ryan Starr Jones.
But more importantly, the flip of the calendar to August marks the beginning of a major event, Big Fatty's birthday month.
He formally announces to the audience that he will be turning 52 years old, sharing the biographical detail that he was born in August of 1956 in Atlanta, Georgia.
A city he affectionately and consistently renames Atlanta.
And he doesn't just celebrate himself during this segment. He goes down a really interesting historical rabbit hole.
He takes the time on the air to look up the exact commodity prices from his birth year, 1956. He wants to know the price of a gallon of milk or a loaf of bread back then.
Why? Because his brother and sister-in-law will be turning 50 the following year, and he is doing the research to buy them a hyper-specific, historically accurate nostalgia card.
It's a surprisingly sweet, grounded, traditional family detail right in the middle of all the chaos and explicit rants.
He also drops a quick network update, noting that the podcasting personality known as the Gay Trucker has officially returned to driving trucks, completely dropping his brief, highly confusing stint working as a hairdresser.
But the true centerpiece of this Friday forward-looking segment and moment that ties this entire week's theme together is his interaction with Brian from Boston.
Now, Brian is a central, beloved figure in the BFO audience, often referred to respectfully as the BFO resident historian.
Brian sends in an e-letter outlining his summer vacation plans, which involve a massive multi-state road trip.
And Brian specifically asks if Big Fatty will be around South Kakalaki, which is his term for South Carolina, at the end of August for a potential visit.
And Big Fatty's response to this request on the air is the absolute distillation of explicit, unfiltered BFO hospitality. He doesn't just say, sure, let's grab a coffee.
No, he eagerly offers to host Brian physically in his home.
And the exact phrasing of his open invitation is legendary. He promises the historian that he will, quote, make sure that the sheets are clean on the visitor's bed and that I give the sling a good wipe down.
Okay, we have to unpack that sentence because it is the ultimate collision of traditional Southern hospitality and extreme explicit sexual subculture.
For those who might not know, a sling in this context is a piece of heavy-duty suspended leather furniture used in the BDSM and leather communities.
It is not exactly standard guest room furniture at a Marriott.
No, it is not. But if we explore how this podcast truly operates, we realize it functions as much more than just a daily audio journal.
It operates as a matchmaking service, a travel agency, and a highly specialized hospitality network for a very specific community.
The digital audience doesn't just listen to the audio files. They physically manifest inside his actual apartment.
The merging of his projected explicit digital persona with his physical domestic reality is absolute and complete.
Exactly. Let's extrapolate on this for a second, because I think this is genuinely historically significant for the internet.
When we look at this hyper-local, hyper-intimate network Big Fatty was actively building in 2008, we are looking at the direct, unvarnished precursor to the modern parasocial relationship.
Today, millions of people feel intensely connected to YouTubers or TikTokers they will never, ever meet in real life. It's a one-way street.
But in the BFO universe, that parasocial connection had actual physical follow-through. You listen to the show, you dial the number and call the voicemail, you get berated on air for pod fading.
And then a month later, you are literally sleeping in the host's guest room after he wipes down the leather equipment for you.
It is a level of access and physical intimacy that modern content creators would find absolutely terrifying.
It requires a level of trust and a complete demolition of personal boundaries that is incredibly rare today. He literally invites the audience into his most private spaces.
Biologically, as we saw with the frantic vacation poop story, and physically, as we see with his open door policy for Brian from Boston.
Which leaves us with a profound, almost provocative thought for you to mull over as we wrap up this journey into the archives.
Think about the timeline here. Long before the era of modern social media, where everyone overshares specifically to hack an algorithm for clout, Big Fatty was actively turning the mundane layout of his apartment.
The horrifying realities of his bowel movements.
And the highly explicit furniture in his guest room into compelling, daily, must-listen audio.
He built a dedicated global community, not by projecting a polished Apple Store level of perfection, but by leading with his absolute worst, most vulnerable, unvarnished moments.
So consider this as you go about your week. Does the modern instinct to heavily curate our flaws and polish our online personas to a high gloss actually make us more isolated as a society?
Is leading directly into our absolute worst, most vulnerable vacation poop moments the only genuine way to build true, lasting digital intimacy?
Ask yourself, what is the one unglamorous, embarrassing truth that you constantly hide from the world? And what kind of incredibly loyal community might you build if you simply found the courage to share it?
It is a question of authenticity versus curation, and Big Fatty made his choice very clear.
I'm King.
And I'm Gail.
And we want to remind all of you to make sure you tune in next weekend for the newest episode of Ruination, Early Years. See you then.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination, the Early Years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.